Have you ever had a burning question about the Bible, theology, or the Christian faith? One you wish you could ask a world-renowned scholar? Now's your chance. On Ask NT Wright Anything, Professor Tom Wright tackles your biggest faith questions, and we want to hear yours. Submit your question today at premierinsight.org/NTW, and you might hear it answered in an upcoming episode. It's that easy. Visit premierinsight.org/NTW now and be part of the conversation.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
Today we wanted to pick up with a very recently released Supreme Court judgment here in the UK. It just came out this morning as we record, which is relates to a number of episodes and issues we've discussed in the past, all around when families of seriously ill children kind of get into a dispute with the doctors treating them in hospitals. The most famous one of these would have been Archie Battersby, who there's a link to the podcast we've done on him. And his very sad case. He was a young man who was deprived of oxygen for a long time and was kind of in a coma. And the doctors concluded that he was brain dead and that life support should be removed. And his family kind of resisted that very strongly and ended up having to be kind of resolved by the courts, which is the latest in, you know, a large number of similar cases here in the UK. And what the Supreme Court has now decided, very interestingly, is that the doctors involved in these cases cannot be automatically anonymized. Do you want to explain a bit more about that, Dad, and why that's significant?
Yes, I mean, these are very sad and painful cases where you have a child with very, very severe injuries. And normally in these kind of situations, trying to decide what is for the best for the child, because that's what the law says, is that you have to act in the best interests of the child. Normally, it's possible to find an agreement, a consensus between the medical team and the parents. And if there is an agreement between the medical team and the parents that in the child's best interest, the right thing to do is to stop intensive life support treatment, it's not necessary to involve the law courts. The courts are happy for doctors and parents to go on. But if there is a substantial and irreconcilable difference between the doctors and the parents, then these cases are referred to the courts, and then a very long and expensive and complex legal proceedings ensue. And because of the nature of British legal system, it tends to be very confrontational. You have these different parties and they instruct their own legal team and they have their own expert witnesses. And unfortunately, they can be quite confrontational. But what has really transformed the nature of these cases over the last sort of 10, 15 years has been the involvement of social media. Because these cases, what has happened is that traditionally medical confidentiality has always applied, and therefore the doctors involved, the hospital trusts and so on, maintain strict confidentiality. But it's perfectly possible for parents to put all their personal details onto social media. And there have been a number of cases where this has led to a completely over-the-top social media campaign. A kind of rent-a-mob has suddenly appeared outside hospitals, threatening, shouting, demonstrations and so on. And that's particularly painful outside, you know, paediatric hospitals where there are whole sick children or to hear these mobs and so on. And what's happened in these cases is that the doctors have applied to the court for anonymity, that their the names should not be released into the public domain. And the court has given them an indefinite anonymity clause.
That's right. And so when the judgments in these cases are handed down, you might see the names of the parents involved and the lawyers, the judges, the child, but it will just say, you know, Dr. A or Clinician B or something of that order when they give evidence or when they are referred to. And this is seen by the hospital trusts as kind of a necessary step to protect the doctors who are, quote unquote, just doing their job to the best of their ability from the kind of fevered passions of those kind of following along on this story. Because I think it's worth noting here that when these stories get publicized, often by the parents and by their supporters, the facts of the case are often not always communicated particularly well. And so there is a large numbers of people online who misconstrue what is actually at debate here or what the law says. And they think it's, you know, the hospital are trying to kill this beautiful innocent child and the parents are trying to stop them. Or you know, the parents have this plan to, you know, have found a hospital overseas that will look after this child and try this experimental treatment to bring them back from the death, from the brink of death. But those callous NHS monsters won't let this happen. And so there's a lot of very, very serious anger from people who aren't particularly well informed about either medicine or the law because of what they have a kind of cartoonish version of what's actually going on inside the court.
Yeah. And so it's interesting that apparently the legal team for the doctors argued on European human rights legislation that they had a right to private life and privacy and protection of their family, and that overrid the rights of freedom of speech and disclosure. So in both these cases, the children themselves have died many years ago, but in both cases, the parents have a long-held grievance about the quality of care that they receive. They feel that the doctors acted inappropriately and not in their children's best interests, and they feel it's in the public interest for them to be able to tell their story in detail and to criticise the doctors concerned and name them individually. And so this is the case that's gone all the way to the Supreme Court as to whether or not the right to truth for individual clinicians should be named, does that outweigh the right of the clinicians to be protected from a kind of rent-a-mob which might surface on social media?
And so the Supreme Court has ruled just this morning as we record that restricting the kind of default, which is freedom of speech, has to be, quote, established convincingly, and that neither of the NHS trusts involved in the two cases had kind of established that freedom of speech should be overridden. In the written judgment, they said, quote, weight can be given to the importance of protecting the medical staff of public hospitals against unfounded accusations and consequent abuse. However, the court should also bear in mind that the treatment of patients in public hospitals is a matter of legitimate public interest. And so they said there can't be kind of automatic anonymity in these cases. And if a doctor does not want to be named, they would need to apply to the court directly, individually themselves, rather than, as it's been previously, the trust which has been involved in the court case has asked for all the doctors to kind of have blanket anonymity.
Yes, and it's interesting that the great and the good have all lined up, the BMA, British Medical Association, the Royal College of Paediatrics, Child Health, of whom I'm a fellow, so conflict of interest, and the medical profession has, in a sense, joined shoulders to try to protect its own interests. But I feel quite conflicted on this, because certainly, you know, as a paediatrician who's been involved in some of these very painful cases, I can imagine that if there was a great public outcry at something I was involved with, it actually reminds me of, years ago, I was talking to the senior nurse at UCH while I was still working as a paediatrician, and there was another case that had caused a lot of public outcry, and I was thinking, and various people parents had a demonstration against the doctor concerned, and so I said to the senior nurse, you know, I was just thinking, what would happen if all the parents of the doctors who died under my care has suddenly turned up outside my door in Queen's Drive? And she said, they wouldn't fit into Queen's Drive.
Very vote of confidence. Yeah, and I understand where some of the doctors in the medical professions are coming from, in that it is not a totally baseless idea that, you know, if the doctor's names are known, then their addresses will be found out and where they work, and they will be potentially harassed and abused and shouted at, and maybe even worse in public. As I said, you know, this is not to cast aspersions on the grieving families and their legal teams who are going through, as is their right, the court proceedings, but it's about the wider mob, the online mob, often from people who are not even in the UK, who kind of get attached to these as kind of culture war fights. And they think this is about speaking up for life or for Christianity, as we'll come on to discuss how the church gets dragged into this. Think of the NHS as some kind of baby killing institution. And, you know, with that kind of misinformation and kind of willful misunderstanding of the facts of the case and what the doctors are doing, it's not totally spurious to believe that they might be the targets of very serious threats or even physical attacks.
And of course, these are uniquely emotive cases. I mean, you know, if these cases involved, you know, elderly people in their 80s with multiple disabilities and dementia, it would never, I think, have this kind of public outrage and emotive power. And so there is something extremely emotive, understandably, about, you know, a young baby or a young child who has a terrible disease, and where there are arguments about what is genuinely in the child's best interest, and so for those who wish to create public waves, who wish, you know, to increase the amount of media impact and so on, these are inevitably stories which have a lot of potential.
And what is particularly interesting to us, I think, is, as we've mentioned in our previous discussions of these cases, is how often a group called Christian Concern or their kind of sister organization, the Christian Legal Center, have been involved in these cases. I mean, just on the BBC News article that reports on this Supreme Court judgment, they have a picture at the top of the parents of lots of children who have died in these circumstances, who have kind of gathered in solidarity outside the Supreme Court, holding up pictures of their loved ones. And they're holding up a banner that says, "Justice is done in the light," that is emblazoned with the Christian Concern logo. And so there is a sense in which these very painful disputes between a grieving family and doctors, or supposedly judges trying to figure out what is the best interest of the child here, a child who, you know, it appears to be brain dead or has been in life support for a long time and doesn't have any prospect of recovery. You know, should we continue this futile treatment and hope for a miracle? Should we release them to die of natural causes as they would as soon as the ventilation feeding is removed? These very difficult cases have been co-opted into a broader campaign by conservative groups like Christian Concern, who have a story to tell about a kind of atheistic, uncaring bureaucracy in NHS, which is crushing the religious freedoms of parents who are pro-life Christians and want to be able to express their pro-life convictions through, you know, choosing not to turn off life support of their child.
Yes. And I think, I mean, it is an extraordinarily difficult and complex area. I mean, and in particular, what we are seeing more cases, I think it's true to say, is where families who come from a religious background, it could be a Christian group, it could be some other religious background, who believe fervently that God is going to do a miracle, and who therefore believe that the very best of medical intensive care, conventional medical intensive care, should be continued because of their absolute conviction that God is doing, going to do a miracle of healing. And the NHS and the legal system finds itself in this conflict of wishing to respect parents' firmly held beliefs and convictions and concerns, whilst at the same time being responsible for, you know, the use of extremely expensive and limited intensive care resources. And it's, that is often, I think, at the root of this incomprehension on both sides. From a parent's point of view, their conviction about the fact that God is going to do a miracle is such that they cannot see why the doctors should possibly want to stop medical treatment. The doctors feel that from any kind of medical understanding, the damage is completely irreversible, and recovery is not possible. And although they may well hold out, yes, a miracle might happen, but there comes some point at which we have to work on the basis of what our medical evidence shows.
And I think it goes deeper than just kind of a question of whether you believe in faith or whether you believe in science, because I think part of the reason why some particularly kind of more conservative-minded Christians get very energized by these cases is because they are attached to a kind of pre-existing opposition to abortion. And so people say, we are pro-life. We are pro-life when it comes to the unborn child. We don't support abortion. But therefore, that means we must also be pro-life when it comes to people who have already been born. And they, in my view, misunderstand the removal of life-sustaining treatment as effectively killing a person. And therefore, you know, even if God doesn't do a miracle, it is only for God to decide when someone's life comes to an end. And our job as faithful followers of Jesus is to continue to keep people alive until God takes them to be with him. And so therefore, seeking to intervene to accelerate that death it is seen as immoral and unchristian. Which I personally disagree with, and think is a misunderstanding of Christian ethics, but I think is a quite pervasive kind of position among lots of conservative Christians.
Yeah, no, you're right, it is. And I think at its root, this leads to what's sometimes called vitalism, that the purpose of life is to try to maximize the number of heartbeats, to maximize existence of any kind, and even if there is catastrophic injury, it is still worth carrying on intensive care so as to maximize lifespan, and that, as you say, within that framework, switching off the life machinery, life support machinery, is regarded as in some sense causing death and hastening death. I mean, my argument against that would be to say that the only reason the patient is alive is because we have intervened. Yes. I mean, we are holding off death. Death is already here. Death is in this situation. With our technology, we can hold off death for a certain amount of time, but it isn't that we are causing death. Once we take our hands away, death occurs because it's already, sadly, this patient has a fatal disease. And so we're temporarily holding off. And the other thing I would say is that the purpose of intensive care is not to extend life indefinitely. The purpose of intensive care is to provide for a short period to support a patient long enough for the healing processes to occur. That's what intensive care is for. That's why we have intensive care units. They're not intended to provide indefinite life support for years and years and years. The idea is you provide life support for days, possibly weeks, very occasionally months, but just long enough to allow recovery to occur and healing to occur.
And as you say, if healing and recovery does not and indeed cannot occur, then actually continuing life support is an act of faithfulness and trust in God, is actually saying we are going to resist, you know, God has decided, if you believe in that kind of totally kind of all encompassing sovereignty of God, God has decided this person's life has come to an end. And as you say, it is our technology which is forestalling that. And so, you know, I often think when you read the accounts, they often say, you know, we want to leave it to God to decide when so-and-so dies. And I say, well, actually, you've taken it into your own hands by trying to continue life support, because if you left them into the hands of God, they would die very, very quickly without artificial ventilation or feeding or whatever else is going on. So I think there's a strong argument to say, actually, as you say, there, you know, we praise God for the kind of miracle of intensive care, which has saved millions of lives. You know, we think in recently in the pandemic, you know, people put on ventilators, not for the rest of their lives, put on ventilators so that we could get a whole handle of their COVID infection and allow their immune systems to recover long enough to defeat the virus and then come off the ventilator and resume their ordinary lives. We should thank and praise God for the invention of ventilators and intensive care, but none of it was intended to for us to be able to basically reanimate people in this kind of undead state indefinitely.
That's right. And so I would say that although these slogans like pro-life and pro-choice are deeply misleading and can be very unhelpful, nonetheless, I think my stance would be that life is precious and should never be intentionally destroyed. Death should never be intentionally hastened. But because of the fact that we have a bigger perspective, we see life and death in an eternal perspective, that actually death changes. It's possible from death to change from an enemy that we desperately seek to keep away and prevent into a gateway into the next stage of our life. And therefore, there comes a point where we take our hands away, the hands that are holding death away, and we allow death to occur. In order that the gateway into the next stage of existence should happen. So in a very strange way, in the most profoundly cases where damage has been so severe, it's possible to see death actually as a kind of healing, a strange kind of healing, because we have a bigger perspective. It's not just for this time on earth, but it's in the wider context.
Yes. And I think when you read some of these stories and read about the evidence, the medical evidence of, you know, the extent of the brain damage that might have occurred in some of these children, you have to start to ask some challenging, and you need to always be incredibly sensitive, but some challenging questions to the parents and saying, to what extent is your fight for your child for them, or is it because you find it difficult, if not impossible, to admit that your child is gone and needs to be released into the arms of their creator God? You know, when a child has effectively no brain left, you have to say, what is it? Is it a fear of the future? Is it a sense in which you're unable to let go, understandably, of the fact that your child has died? You know, there was no Archie Battersby to come back, you know?
Yeah, I think one of the factors which I've seen repeatedly in these cases, and that is that because the law gives to the parents this crushing sense of responsibility, you know, that they are together with the doctors have to take responsibility. The doctors cannot act on their own. The parents feel this terrible sense of guilt that by agreeing, if the doctors just went ahead and said, well, I'm sorry, we are taking a medical decision, this is the decision, paradoxically, many parents would feel much better because it's nothing to do with me, you know. I didn't want it, but the doctors did it, so there was nothing I could do. But the law says we can't do that. The doctors can't make unilateral decisions. You have to agree. And for some parents, that is to almost give them an intolerable burden of responsibility. I have to collude with the doctors who are saying that the child's has no future life, and I can't do that. I owe it to my child to fight for them. You know, that kind of psychological mechanism is often what happens. And I don't think, you know, as a parent,
it's understandable. It's understandable. And I have 100 times more criticism for some of the outside kind of activist forces that attach themselves somewhat parasitically to these stories. And I would argue at times prolong the parents' kind of agony for their own misconstrued cultural, religious, political ends than I do for parents who didn't ask for this, who were plunged into this horrible situation through no fault or choice of their own, and have got no experience in trying to wrestle with the implications of their child suffering a terrible, terrible illness or tragedy. I mean, all that said, while I tend to be more sympathetic to the medical side of these court cases, as I've been reflecting on this Supreme Court case and about whether we should name the doctors, I actually have a lot of sympathy for the parents and their argument that doctors should be named. I guess this is the journalist in me, but I think there is a lot of merit to what the Supreme Court have judged, which is that, you know, doctors paid by the taxpayer working in public hospitals should by default be accountable for their actions and their decisions. And we need strong exceptional arguments not to name them in court documents, as we would name lawyers, the judges, the parents, everyone else.
Yeah, and I can see that too. And although, interestingly, does that mean that if this was all taking place in a private hospital, you'd have different criteria? I mean, is it the fact that it's the NHS which makes the difference, or is it? I think it's probably more to do with the fact that ultimately, the truth and honesty should outweigh the protection of doctors, and that, you know, when you're acting as a professional, you take along that responsibility. I mean, you know, some people complain that doctors, you know, their salaries are excessive and all the rest, but this is why you pay consultants, because they take these kind of life and death decisions which you have to live with for the rest of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's a different story if an individual doctor can bring evidence to a court that they are particularly under threat. There is, you know, discrete evidence of them in person being kind of targeted at an unacceptable level of harassment or abuse, then I'm open to individual anonymity orders on a kind of case by case basis. But I think in general, I would say that if you are, you know, you should be able to justify the decisions that you have made. If you believe them to be medically justified in the best interest of the patient and according to the law, you shouldn't be afraid to be named and to justify. And I think there is merit in giving the parents the choice, as they are asking for, to kind of tell their own stories. You know, I might disagree with their interpretation of events, or I might disagree with their suggestions about how things could have unfolded differently. But I believe in a free society, people should, within reason, have the ability to tell their own stories and to raise, you know, awareness of what has happened to their child as they understand it, so that in the great marketplace of ideas, as we're doing right now in this podcast, we can hash out. This is a very legitimate and important public debate that society needs to have. It shouldn't just be locked away inside kind of closed off courtrooms. It needs to be engaged across all levels of society. And I think greater transparency can aid that.
Have you ever found yourself in a conversation about faith and struggled to find the right words? Maybe you've been challenged by tough questions and felt unprepared to respond. That's why our Confident Christianity course was created. It's an interactive online course designed to help you understand and share your faith with clarity and conviction. You'll gain the knowledge and skills to engage in meaningful conversations and confidently defend what you believe. Right now, you can get access to this powerful course as a special thank you for your gift to Premier Insight today. Your generosity helps bring resources like this to more people seeking truth. Get access today and start equipping yourself for those important moments. Just visit premierinsight.org/confident. That's premierinsight.org/confident.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And our second story for this episode, by total coincidence, comes also from a Supreme Court here in the UK. Supreme Court judgment handed down at exactly the same time as the one we mentioned regarding anonymity of doctors, but on a totally different subject. And this is a ruling about the definition of sex and gender in UK law. It's a bit technical, so let me just try and very briefly explain before we get on to the more interesting question. So the Scottish government passed a law or a regulation that said women had to make up a certain percentage of kind of company boards. And in their definition of women, they said it was included women, trans women, who had what is in the UK is called a gender recognition certificate. So this is a legal process by which people can be assessed by doctors and ultimately a panel. And if they conclude that, yes, this person has got diagnosable gender dysphoria and has been living as the other sex for at least 2 years, they can be given a gender recognition certificate, which means that in the eyes of the state, they are recognized as being the other gender. They can have their passport changed and all this kind of stuff. And there was a campaign group called For Women Scotland, which brought a case against the Scottish government saying, hang on, you can't include trans women with this certificate in your definition of women. It can only include women who are born women, biologically women, born women. And this case, this dispute has kind of rumbled all the way through the courts and has eventually reached the top of the pile at the Supreme Court, which has come out with its judgment today.
Yes, and this does seem like quite an important judgment from the Supreme Court, where they have come down very strongly and said that it's biological sex which defines whether you're a man or a woman as far as the Equality Act is concerned, and therefore their ruling is that a trans woman, a man, somebody born a man who then has transitioned to a woman, cannot be treated as a woman according to the Equality Act. That's my understanding of the judgment.
Yeah. So this should we just explain as well, particularly to those not from the UK, the Equality Act is a very significant piece of legislation passed in 2010, which is kind of the bedrock of a kind of equal rights regime here in the UK. So it sets out protected characteristics, as they're called, and says that you cannot discriminate against people according to these protected characteristics. One of those characteristics is sex. And another one, interestingly, is gender reassignment. So it means you can't discriminate when you're providing services as in a business or something else on someone because they're a trans person. You can't say, oh, we don't serve trans people here. But equally, you can't discriminate along the grounds of sex, except that there are obviously exceptions made for kind of single sex spaces like swimming pool changing rooms or women's refuges. And a large part of this is been trying to understand, what does the Equality Act mean when it says sex? Does it just mean biological women, those who are born women? Or does it include trans women, men who have become women after they have been recognised as such by this gender recognition panel and got their certificate? And the Supreme Court, as you say, very unequivocally said, no. The protected characteristic of sex only includes those who are born women, not those who have a certificate.
So this certainly seems like a significant judgment because it challenges the narrative coming from the trans groups that I should be able to define myself as whatever I wish.
Yeah.
And if I've defined myself as a woman, I should then be able to have all the privileges of women, including using women's toilets and so on. And not surprisingly, a number of women, including feminists, have argued strongly against this and said that they feel threatened by the presence of people who were born as men using their spaces.
Yeah, and there's been a few particularly controversial stories in recent years in the UK. There was a case of a rapist, a convicted imprisoned rapist who said that they had transitioned to becoming a woman, and the Scottish prison service where they were imprisoned moved them into a women's only prison, which caused kind of uproar and outcry and understandable outrage from a lot of kind of feminist women's groups. and he/she was swiftly put back into a male prison. So there's this kind of idea that I think people are, there's a general sense in British society that, you know, trans people should be free to live their lives in kind of dignity and not interfered with, but there is a line, and it is understandable that most women do not want kind of male bodied people, whatever certificate, whatever transition process they might have been through, going into very specific spaces that have been set aside for women for their own protection, you know, women's prisons, women's refuges, women's changing rooms, women's toilets.
And I do find this very interesting from a sort of broader philosophical perspective, because, you know, philosophically, for hundreds of years, the dominant position has been that ultimately reality is the way it is, even if we would wish it was different. And one of the biological realities is that we're all born either as male or female. However much we would wish that not to be the case, until recently, it was felt that sanity was accepting what is the case, and that actually pretending that something different was not a healthy or a functional way to live. But what we've had developing is a different understanding, which... one philosopher, Charles Taylor, has used the phrase expressive individualism, where I, inside my head, the only person who can understand who I am and what my identity is inside me, and my duty is to express my own individual uniqueness, and no one else has the right to impede or restrict the expression of my own unique identity. That's expressive individualism. And if I feel that I've been born into the wrong body, that I'm really a woman, even though I find myself in this repulsive male body, and I'm repelled by everything that is, as I look at my body, I say, this is not me, this is not my body, then I should be free to change reality, including changing my body, to accord with the reality that is inside my head.
And this has kind of led to the development of what's often known as the kind of theory of gender identity, which is that inside all of us is this kind of unmeasurable, unquantifiable identity of gender, and that is your true sex, irrespective of what the outside of your body, whatever size gametes you have, what chromosomes you have, what genitalia you have. Your gender identity is a free-floating thing that is not necessarily connected to your biology, and that is your true sex. And so that's why you get the language of assigned gender, assigned at birth. And the theory is that human being is born and the doctors and the parents have a look and say, I'm going to assign you to the male category or the female category. And trans people are those who actually their gender identity was the other one and they were misassigned. And so that's why it's no longer kind of polite to talk about this as sex change surgery. It's gender reassignment, because their sex has and always will be male or female according to the gender identity. And all the operation is doing is correcting the misalignment, the wrong assignment of gender at birth.
Yeah, and so philosophically, it's this sort of interesting shift, isn't it, from where is ultimate reality based? Is ultimate reality out there in the material world, or is it in my head, in my own beliefs? And I think that there are this shift away from an external reality that we can all agree into this invisible, internal, but incredibly important thing inside my deepest self is a very striking shift in the way that culture thinks the way that we think. And some people have said that it has some linkage with the ancient Christian heresy or belief system of Gnosticism, which regarded the body as a sort of stinking cesspit of no value at all. But the important thing was this spark, the spiritual spark that was inside me, and that what I had to do is nurture that spiritual spark. And this contempt for the body is one of the features of this gender reassignment surgery, because, you know, here is a perfectly healthy body which is now subject to the most extraordinarily damaging and mutilating surgery because it is held with contempt by its owner.
Yes, and you can see when you read the epistles, which kind of allude to Gnosticism in the New Testament, or kind of proto-Gnosticism, because it doesn't really fully develop until a bit later after the biblical period. You know, you can see that Paul and the other kind of apostles are quite strongly cautioning the Christians against falling into this kind of, it's quite a kind of a Platonic idea, the division between the bodily is base and is lowly and is earthly and is yucky, and the truly virtuous, the pure, the godly, the eternal is the spiritual, the non-bodily. And therefore, what you do with your body is of no account. You can sleep around, you can overeat, you can do X, Y, and Z, as long as, you know, your eternal soul remains unsullied by all of this. And Paul and the Christians are saying, no, this is not Christianity. And we know that because of the incarnation. We know that because God came as Jesus and was completely and fully embodied. That shows us that we can't have this kind of bright, clear dividing line between the good, the immaterial, and the spiritual, and the bad, the physical. We are embodied creatures, and therefore what we do with our bodies, which were given to us, created for us by God, really counts, really matters. We cannot transcend them. We cannot dismiss them.
Yeah, and in fact, in extraordinary language, which has now been devalued, is the idea that the body is a temple. You know, that now becomes a kind of trivial, oh yes, the body is a temple, is a sort of
trope, a meme.
Yeah, a trope, isn't it? But actually, when it was Jesus who first said, destroy this temple, and it will raise again in three days. But the temple of which he spoke was his body. And then that passes on into the New Testament. Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit? So this idea that this, you know, that is a very wonderful, profound imagery, isn't it? Here is this, what is a temple? It's a physical building, a structure, a complex structure. But why is it significant? It's significant because it is haunted by the Spirit. Yeah. It is the dwelling place.
Yeah. To people listening to Jesus say that, or even those, the kind of Jewish background believers hearing Paul say that, it is astonishing. You know, we get very clear, body is a temple, look after yourself. But actually, to the first century Jews, the temple is the literal center of the universe. It's the sole point on earth where God is present in the Holy of Holies. It is the pinnacle of their civilization. It is something cherished that they've carried since the Ark of the Covenant back in the tabernacle days in the desert. And when Jesus says, each of you are now as sacred, as important, as precious, as divinized as the temple was, is an astonishing thing to be told, that you need to cherish your body like the people of Israel cherish their physical temple.
That's absolutely right. And particularly, it wasn't just the elite athletes. So there was the cult of the body beautiful, in the Greek world, but it was the small group of athletes. What now Christianity is saying is that everybody, every single body is a temple to be cherished, to be respected, to be protected, to be treated with care. And so I think that sense of respect, concern, care for the human body was a uniquely Christian contribution to culture And obviously many times in Christian history that has not been lived out or demonstrated, but it has its core. And very often in Christian healthcare, you know, going all the way back to the early monasteries with the tenderness with which the bodies of the, you know, the beggars and the leprosy victims were cared for and washed and treated with respect. Why? Because I'm tending the wounds of Christ, because this body is precious.
I mean, there's that famous quote, isn't there, from C.S. Lewis in an essay or a book where he says, you know, next to the sacrament itself, every human being you see is the most precious, the most sacred thing you'll ever see.
Yeah.
Because they each, you know, carry, you know, marked by their creator and are made in the image of God. And that really should mark how we approach each other, Christians and non-Christians alike. And I think that's why a lot of Christians will find themselves in agreement with the Supreme Court here in their kind of drawing a line and saying, actually, we don't agree that bodies can be overridden by an internal sense of gender identity, that sex matters, that biology is real and immutable. But I just want to kind of throw a potential objection from some, because there are lots of Christian traditions and particularly contemporary Christian theologians who would disagree with this. You know, some people say, you know, we need to make sure that we don't fall into a kind of a natural law kind of fallacy, which is that we look at the world around us and the way that it is tells us the way that it ought to be. Because actually, as Christians, we know that the way that the world is right now is not exactly how God intended it to be, because the fall, our human rebellion and sin has corrupted all of created order. We had Sharon Dierks, didn't we, on the podcast talking about natural disasters and diseases and how do we understand those as Christians? And in part of the answer is because these things, this brokenness is not how part of God's original design, but is a consequence of the fall. And so there are some Christian theologians who've taken that argument and said, well, hold on, what if people who experience severe gender dysphoria, who have that sense of repugnance and disgust and unease with their bodies, their sexed bodies, what if that is not something that we should dismiss or scoff at, but actually say, maybe these are people who were supposed to be the other sex, that they feel deeply in their heads, and the reason they're not in that body is a consequence of the fall, is a consequence of the brokenness of creation. And so in that sense, gender transition, reassignment surgery, sex change, whatever language you want to use, rather than being a kind of mutilation, this is an attempt, half-hearted perhaps, we don't quite have it, but an attempt to turn bodies back to where they are, akin to when we do, you know, when a child is born with some other kind of deformity or disability, there are sometimes we will do surgeries and interfere to try and correct it to what we believe the creator's intention was.
Yeah, and you're right, some people would make that case. I think I'm not at all persuaded. I think there would be several things I'd want to say. The first is that here we have this person who has, from a medical point of view, a completely healthy, well-grown body, a wonderful gift from God. But they have intense psychological suffering. Of that, there is absolutely no doubt. And I am absolutely aware and have spoken to people with gender dysphoria, the level of suffering, of psychiatric suffering that they are going through. But in the rest of the medicine, we don't deform a body in order to treat psychological suffering. We try to understand the cause of the suffering and engage with that rather than perform mutilating surgery. In other words, you can't really call it restoration. You can't, when you attempt to convert the different kind of genitalia out of it, it's not in any sense a restoration. It's a deformation. It's a destructive act. So I think calling it restoration is misleading. I think recognizing the depth of the suffering is very important, and therefore, and of course, it is true that gender dysphoria does go along with other kinds of psychological suffering, and therefore addressing the deeper causes of suffering and so on, rather than treating it as tended to be as like an utterly separate condition, which is entirely different from any other kind of psychological suffering. But then the third thing I would say is that part of the problem, I think, here is that we the modern culture has bought into an incredibly strict kind of gender dimorphism, that this is what men do. Men dress like this. Men behave like this. Men like rugby. And this is what women do. Women dress in pink and they're very curly and they like girly type things. And that's the only way to be. You're either a man's man or a girl's girl. And I think that is just ridiculous. Because in previous cultures, that was never the case.
Yes.
In previous cultures, there were many, many different ways of being a man. And I would want to say there are many, many different ways of being a Christian man.
Yeah.
And there are he men and there are girly men and there are athletic men and there are artistic men and there are men who cry and there are, are men who love doing girly things and cooking and so what, you know, they're all ways of being a man. And similarly, there are many, many different ways of being a woman. So rather than this gender stereotyping that says the only way I can be, I can't be in this body, surely what we want to celebrate is the diversity of the different ways of being a woman, yes, different ways of being a man.
And there is a profound irony I've noticed for a long time now, which is that there are kind of almost these parallel twin tracks among some parts of the political left, the kind of progressive movement, which has spent, you know, most of my adult life, if not my entire life, you know, 20, 30 years trying to kind of degender children and say, you know, why shouldn't my little girl have dinosaurs and rocket ship toys and be able to wear quote unquote boyish clothes, and you know, they don't all have to be into pink Barbies and princess dresses, and why can't my little son enjoy wearing dresses if they want to and play with a doll and if that makes them happy, you know, toys don't need to be gendered, let children be children. And at the same time, sometimes that exact same political movement says, my son enjoys wearing a dress and playing with a doll. I think he is actually she, and we should put them on puberty blockers as a precursor to surgery when they turn 16. And when you look at, we talked about gender identity, when you look at some of the ways some of these kind of pro-trans organizations try and define gender identity, you know, how do you know what your gender identity is? It is often startlingly reductionist and almost 1950s in its very kind tight of level of understanding of what it means. Do you like playing with trucks? Well, you might actually be a man. Do you like playing with dolls? Have you considered the fact you might actually be a woman or a girl? And actually, as you say, that's quite conservative. That's quite regressive, not progressive.
I think that's right. And I think in the bad old days, paradoxically, there seemed to be much greater recognition and freedom of what a woman could be, and what a man could be, and now we because of this sort of confusion over gender identity, we seem to be more stereotyping. So I think I still would therefore want to defend a view that says that in general gender reassignment surgery is not the best approach. The best approach is to try and become the person God made me to be, in with my uniqueness. But the other final thing I think I would want to say, and that is, I'm afraid that this judgment will be seized by right wing groups, both this side and the other side of the pond, as being a wonderful victory for the straight majority, and we'll stick it to the transgender minorities. And sadly, the truth is that transgender minorities already suffer a huge amount of abuse and attacks, discrimination of various kinds. I know the statistics show they're much more likely to commit suicide than other people. They have a long litany of discrimination, problems, abuse, and so on. And so I think as Christian people, we need to be very strongly on the side of trying to protect people from abuse and from discrimination, trans people, and should be, rather than being seen as the enemy, we should be seen as people who are on their side and wanting to support them, whilst we don't necessarily agree with the stance they're taking.
Yeah, I entirely agree with that. And I think it is telling, isn't it, that, you know, we mentioned this when we talked about trans children and kind of gender issues in children with Dr. Julie Maxwell on a couple of episodes last year and the year before. about how it feels like the tide is turning. You know, before this ruling came out, it definitely felt like the kind of high point of the kind of pro-trans movement had peaked, at least certainly in the UK and possibly also the US. And there was a kind of general turning away and a kind of turning back towards immutable biology by a lot of institutions. I mean, it's notable that this ruling has been kind of broadly welcomed by both the left and the right wing parties here in the UK, the government and the opposition. And I think there's a lot of Christians have kind of been quite triumphalist about that, you know, that this kind of unexpected alliance with radical feminists in pushing back on trans ideology has been quite successful, and the kind of quote unquote we're winning the culture war. And while, as I say, I agree with some of the ideology there, and I you know, celebrate this Supreme Court ruling, I think it's a real sadness to me that so many Christians have joined in this idea of kind of, as you say, demonizing what is objectively a kind of persecuted and vulnerable minority. There's lots to disagree with about aspects of sort of the trans movement, and particularly some of their demands around kind of youth gender medicine that's been quite harmful. But fundamentally, you know, with the exception of a few cases where it really counts, you know, women's prisons and you know, single sex changing rooms, I think broadly in a free society, people should be free to live their life as they say fit, as long as it's not causing harm to others. And that means that if someone with extreme gender dysphoria has chosen to, you know, wear clothes that doesn't match up with their outward appearance, they should be free to do that, change their hairstyle if that's what they wish as an adult. And Christians, as you say, should not be kind of jumping on the shifting tides of culture and trying to bully this minority out of existence, but instead trying to look after them, protect them, to love them, you know, in the way that Jesus modeled. You know, what did Jesus do when he came across prostitutes, you know, who were clearly reviled by the kind of mainstream first century Jewish society, or tax collectors? You know, he didn't agree with them. He didn't say to Zacchaeus, crack on, keep on stealing from people, and all the women caught in adultery, you know, you've done nothing wrong. But he absolutely recognized their vulnerability, their dignity, and their inherent worth in the eyes of God. And he stood between them and the mob, including the ultra religious zealots of the day who were trying to tear them down.
Yes, and we had a previous conversation about shame, didn't we? And it strikes me that for whatever reason, many people within the trans movement feel shame.
Yeah.
And they are treated as shamed by others. They're named and shamed. And the instinct from of Christ is clothing, acceptance, and recognition of that they're still human beings made in God's image.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm sure we'll return to this issue because it's not going anywhere, not least because, you know, these discussions about gender and sex spill over into the other church debates about gay marriage and all that kind of stuff. So I'm sure we'll return to this topic in the future. But that's all for this episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you've got any questions either on this or on the first half, we talked about, you know, naming doctors involved in these tragic end of life cases. We'd love to hear your own perspectives, particularly if you are in the healthcare professions yourself, or if you're a trans person or you have family and friends who are. We'd love to know your thoughts on what we've been talking about. Or if you have any suggestions for other episodes, other ideas for things we could record and discuss, please do get in touch. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. And you can also find lots of other resources and interesting things to listen to and watch and read on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. Or you can find some of my journalism on my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, I would point people who are interested towards my weekly newsletter on church news called The Critical Friend. That's all. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.